TFM.
Welcome, Stargazers, to another episode of The Artificial Tango, our dedicated Star Trek Picard podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is, at least I think it's him, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Now, Matthew, how can I be sure that this is you and you're not a changeling?
Well, you know, Chris, I think we got off on the wrong foot. You have wonderful leadership potential, and you know, I think you're well dressed, have great hygiene. All of these are things I would say, you know, if I was a changeling and not just a dick. So.
Yeah. All right. Well. It must be you here, I guess. All right. So anyway, everyone, we're going to continue our look at Star Trek Picard Season 3 as it unfolds today with Episode 4, No Win Scenario. And Matthew, let's just jump right in and talk about Picard and Jack, because finally that dynamic, or at least Jack's views towards his dad, are starting to make a lot more sense now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's always interesting to me that every single episode of this series is starting with a flashback that's helping kind of inform what's happening in the present, and this one is no different. And Picard is at 10 Ford Avenue about 5 years ago at this point in the story, and some cadets come up and they want to hear some stories from him, and so he begins to regale them with tales, and once Picard gets going, he doesn't stop. And what we don't realize is that Jack was actually there on that day, and it was the day that he had come to see about his father. And he asks his father a question, which is, after all of these tales that he's been listening to, he asks Jean-Luc about whether or not he had ever had a real family. And Picard's answer to him is that Starfleet is the only family I've ever needed, which makes sense for where Picard is in his life at this moment. We haven't been through the crucible of season two. We have a Picard here who is, I think, probably still smarting from the fact that Beverly has been incommunicado for 15 years and still dealing with that rejection. And so Jack, of course, assumes basically that that means that Picard doesn't need him, right? He takes it in that way. And it's a very interesting story because there's so much happening. And I think one of the things that I really appreciate about this whole part of the story is that it is taking into consideration everything that happened in season two, season one, all of the previous stuff we know about Picard from the rest of the series, and his standoffishness. I think it does a great job of, though, allowing us to have the lesson that he learned at the end of The Next Generation, to which Starfleet and that crew became his family, right? He sits down with them and starts playing cards. You know, he lets some vulnerability be there. And yet, you know, I think the most beautiful thing about all of this is that Jack keeps talking about, as they're having this discussion, that, you know, this isn't something I need. And I love the vulnerability of Picard saying, no, this is a moment I think I need. And it really does show, I think, how much the character of Picard has grown. And so this whole part of the story, I thought, was really phenomenal, because you can really sense the way in which Jack is putting up a front that this is not something that he needs or cares about.
Right, right.
And I thought the most beautiful part of this is that I don't think that he actually realizes what Jean-Luc was saying in the bar until the moment at the end of the episode on the bridge where everybody's celebrating, everybody's hugging on the bridge. And he actually gets to see and experience the way in which crews become a family. That was not just a platitude for Picard to be saying, but actually a reality that these people do in some ways. If you're not on a ship that and has your family as well, these people become your family. And I think this whole thing was intricately woven well, but it also, I think, redeems Beverly in some ways by the fact that she truly did tell her son to go see Picard, and it really was Jack's choice. We get to see that instead of just hearing about it, which I think helps us understand this relationship between Beverly and Jean-Luc and Jack all together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, what I found interesting about that point is that I never doubted that Beverly encouraged Jack to go find his dad and meet him and learn about him and maybe try to have a relationship with him. But when we discussed it last time, I didn't yet realize that Jack had made this kind of effort to do so. Mm-hmm. I thought that it was probably more of a case of him being disinterested because he harbored this resentment towards Jean-Luc and he didn't want to have anything to do with him. But the fact that he actually did go and seek him out, and he was there in the 10 Forward bar that night, and he heard the statement that Picard made about family, which he misconstrued, it changes the way I view the situation a little bit. I do think it's very convenient that he knew where to go. I guess Picard like goes there and has his meal every day. Is like a known thing that you can find Admiral Picard there. It's one of those things that feels quite convenient for the TV show and for the story, but you know, that Jack would be sitting over there by the bar with his hat on. But you know, it works fine for the story. It's easy to understand how he took Jean-Luc's statements as being dismissive of him and a rejection of the fact that he has this son. And now Beverly told Jack about his dad and that Jean-Luc was his father, but Jean-Luc didn't know that he had the son.
Right, exactly.
And so that really plays into the dynamic there, because it isn't like Jean-Luc knew he had the son and he just never did anything. But Jack's reaction of taking that statement as, you know, Starfleet's the only family I've ever needed, and that being a rejection of him, it's sort of like Jack is reading into it the idea that Jean-Luc made this conscious decision not to have a family with Beverly and Jack, which is not what happened. But I guess when you're that age, your ability to put all these pieces together in a rational way isn't fully developed yet.
Right.
It would make a little more sense to me if in that moment of that encounter, Jack were like 14 or 15, but actually at some point in this episode, Jean-Luc says, "You're what, 23, 24? And Jack just kind of nods. So we still don't know exactly if he's 23 or if he's 24. Yeah. Or if he's 25, or, you know, he's somewhere in that range. But if those flashback scenes were 5 years earlier, it means Jack was probably about 18, 19. Right. So he's at a point where he's kind of transitioning to adulthood in the way he thinks. And so I think that, and as someone who actually has lived through this, as I mentioned last time on our previous discussion, I can put myself in Jack's shoes. I can understand the situation on certain levels. My situation wasn't exactly the same, but there were a lot of similarities.
Right.
And because I can look at it from that way, I do feel a little bit like here for the story and for the writing that it's not as complex as I would personally like it to be in terms of the relationship dynamics. But at the same time, I know that if you really fleshed it out in the way that I think would truly be realistic, it would be hard to do it in a 10-episode season and keep the story moving along. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that it works, and, you know, and in some ways, I'm coming to the opinion that having things be a little bit simpler and really bit kind of mundane and normal, right, actually mm-hmm. are a benefit to this part of the story, because I think that there are so many people that can relate to these type of issues. Mm-hmm. And the way in which, and I think this is, you know, one of the lessons here is, you know, you can never assume what's really going on with someone without talking to them. And so the fact that Jack doesn't actually follow up with Jean-Luc there is a mistake, because he assumes that he knows what Jean-Luc means. But he doesn't actually truly understand what Jean-Luc meant until that moment he's standing on the bridge, like I mentioned in this episode. And he gets a chance to actually see what it is that these crews go through that bring them together in a way that he can't even comprehend in that moment, right? And so by not having that conversation and making an assumption, it's incorrect. And so, and of course, I think the beauty of this is that there is an emotional part of Picard here that is not as free as it is after season two of this show, and that hasn't happened yet. Therefore, there may be a part of Picard who is saying that in a way that is a rationale for him never actually having a family and trying to make himself feel better at that. So I think the thing about this is there's so many different wonderful ways that you can read this to which really, truly, I think make a lot of sense. And I even appreciated the way in which, you know, Jack doesn't even quite know how to have a conversation at all. And so he mm-hmm. starts off with the joke, you know, about the hair, you know, the elephant mm-hmm. in the room. The other part of that too, you know, he kind of rejects his dad in a way where he's like, I'm not really a wine guy, you know.
Right.
So nice to know that Jameson is still super cheap whiskey, even in the 25th century. But, you know, there's this whole scene is so charged between them, right? And what I'm fascinated to see is that now that we have had this conversation, we've had this moment where they've had to work together as a family, him and Beverly and Jean-Luc, to help save everyone. You know, does this continue to allow the barriers to be dropped between them? You know, lower the shields and allow them to truly let each other in their lives, mm-hmm. which, you know, like you said, and actually, you know, one of the things that Terry Matalas has actually said, they only have 10 episodes. So things can't take forever. And, you know, I think it also does help that we're in a lot of life and death situations, mm-hmm. which also allow things to move a little bit more quickly when, you know, people feel like it's their last conversation. You know, you might drop the F-bomb. So
you might. When Jean-Luc did that, my first thought was, I wonder what Matthew thinks about them dropping this in here, because it's really unnecessary. And it did feel a bit like that modern Star Trek tendency to, mm-hmm. you know, hey,
yeah,
we're not on broadcast TV, so let's let the language fly. So
I think
periodically
when I think about the situation that they're in, I think, obviously Picard himself feels very much as though this may be the last conversation he ever has with his son. And so I think there is, and this is something that Metallus said, which was that Patrick Stewart inserted this line himself. This wasn't in the script. Okay. It was a part of the performance that he gave. And so I think that there's an honesty there of, when Picard thinks of the idea of what happened then in those 10 grueling hours, this in some ways rivals that, right? Like that there are very few hours left. He has no idea if they'll find a way out of this situation. And I think it's a little bit of frustration coming into the telling of that story that's very personal. I did not have as much of an issue with it there, mainly just because I felt as though I could understand. I myself, not perfect. I do myself when I'm frustrated or whatnot, drop the F-bomb. It happens, right?
Yeah, no, so, I do too. Never on mic, and yes, usually exactly. Not in everyday life, but yeah,
yes.
Under pressure,
so,
frustration
I think that
sometimes,
this is a moment to which it felt earned, basically, right? I don't know who it was, and I can't quote them, but I did see somewhere, with everything that this man has been through in all of his, I think he's supposed to be 96 years, and thinking this might be the last moments of his life, I think if anybody's earned an F-bomb, it's him.
Yeah, I would agree with that. All right. Well, last thing I want to say about Picard and Jack before we move on is just the way the episode ends. I feel like they've both come around. Jack has realized who his father really is and the relationship that they could have. And then Picard has realized how his absence and that misunderstood line affected Jack as well,
right,
even though it wasn't intentional. And so I thought it was nice the way that it came together at the end. And again, through the acting and through the facial expressions, more so than through anything that was said.
And one more thing I'll add to that just real quick is that I also believe that as you were saying that, I was like, this is Jack actually realizing that what Riker said about Picard of him being the greatest man he's ever known, Jack has actually gotten an opportunity to witness a little bit of that. And so I 100% agree with you. And I think, again, this is the place where I think that this season is going to lead to a lot of ability to rewatch the episodes and then really be piecing together the ways in which the writing was connecting every single, emotional beat that characters were having with previous statements that then get played out. So, they tell you something and then you actually see it happen. So they show it to you, which is excellent storytelling in television.
Yeah. While we're talking about Picard, let's talk about Picard and Riker for a minute. And specifically because we're talking about family, I think we should talk about Riker because we learn a bit more in here about what's going on with Riker and Deanna. And I think in this 59-minute episode, I believe it is, we really see Riker go through a lot of emotional states, and he goes from just being resigned to the fact that this is the end, as he tells Jean-Luc, and you got to get things in order. And
get your affairs in order.
Get your affairs in order, and this is the end. And he's very pessimistic through much of the situation. He wants to follow Starfleet protocol, which the Riker that we've known over the years wouldn't just sit back and follow Starfleet protocol when he knows that doing so is not going to get them out of the situation. But it just feels like he's given up. And even when Jack comes up with this idea of using the nebula and the nacelles as a way to push them out, he doesn't really want to hear that either. He says, that can't possibly work. But then he comes around and let's try it. And then through everything else that happens to the end with the birth of the space babies and all, it's like life has been breathed back into him. Mm-hmm. And he's ready to mend whatever has happened with Deanna. And also, as you pointed out in our outline, he's finally able to come to terms with the thing that's really at the heart of his whole malaise, which is not being able to move on with life after the death of his son.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think this is one of those places where, you know, I think of the way in which Nick Meyer picked up on bits and pieces of the original series to create the TOS characters in the films that we, you know, came to know. And in many ways, I think when we think of the TOS characters, they're so informed, especially by Nick Meyer's movies, 2 and 6. Mm-hmm. And so much of that is where he's taking just little moments, little things from the original series to pull out and then extrapolate, you know, character development for these characters. And I think, you know, what's really nice, again, is Metalis and the writers here harkening back to the fact that Star Trek Picard Season 1 lets us know what happened to the Rikers and the fact that their son had died. Because of, you know, talk about somebody being a dick, Starfleet being dicks and not allowing, you know, them to save their son with technology that Starfleet now deems dangerous in light of what happened, which is the fact that we would not put life above something like that is ridiculous, you know. And then to hear that Riker himself has been dealing with this pain of not being able to find the joy in life with the death of his son, and to be able to see that life is that there is still beauty out there, that there is still wonder and excitement. And I think it's Jonathan Frakes' best performance ever in Star Trek. I mean, hands down, I don't think he's ever given a better performance than this. But at the same time, I think that the writing just gives him the ability to sink his teeth into something that resonates so deeply of a father who is just mourning the loss of their child and doesn't know how to go on. And therefore, too, it gives us the ability to understand why he was so mad at Jean-Luc in the last episode, because he's taking out his frustration and anger at the situation that he doesn't have that opportunity ever again. And Jean-Luc seems to be dismissing it. And I just thought this whole thing was great. And then the beauty of Jean-Luc, Jack, and Beverly drawing out of Riker the man he used to be and helping him see that, you know, in many ways, you know, this whole series is about, or this whole episode is about the idea of what McCoy tells Kirk: you take death and turn it into a fighting chance to live. And that's mm-hmm. what these characters are having to do in this moment. They're in the jaws of death and they're snatching it out of its hands by trying this crazy ass maneuver. Right. And it is great to see these characters do that. And I think the beauty of that is that that's what family or found family is able to do for each other, right? Mm-hmm. They're able to know you deeply and help you find a way forward even when you don't think there is one. And to watch Riker go through that in these last few episodes, and actually, in many ways, I think this episode is kind of the finishing of like an arc in the season, and mm-hmm. then we're going to kind of jump into a new one. And Riker's arc feels very, not completely completed, mm-hmm. but very much explored at this point, so that I don't think that we will be getting quite as much as in depth with that character as we move forward, because we've mm-hmm. kind of been able to bring him to the place he needs to be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Riker throwing the asteroid at the Shrike with the tractor beam was the signal that Riker's back to the Riker that
talk about a new Riker maneuver.
Well, that's exactly what I was thinking was, and I think I mentioned this in a previous discussion, the Riker we saw in Insurrection, who's going to scoop up the gas and ram it down their throat, that is him throwing the asteroid at the Shrike as well. So, like, everything that you just talked about of how Beverly and Jean-Luc in particular helped him find himself, come out of that malaise and find himself again, the moment that he did that, and Beverly says, it is Beverly who says it, right? Beverly says,
did you just throw an asteroid
at the ship? He's like, I sure did, you know? So that was, it's like the ending of an arc, I guess, is a good way of putting it. Like, finally, they've pulled him back. And then I think that the Riker that we'll see through the rest of the season will be that Riker that we knew for so long. And it's going to be interesting to see if, and I am assuming that she will, if Deanna actually comes out of the view screen and comes into the real world with Riker together in some upcoming episodes, because so far we've only seen her on that view screen.
Just one quick thing, as you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, Jack says to Jean-Luc in the first episode, I believe it is, where he's like, is there anybody that you know that's the same person that you knew 20 years ago? And the beauty of that is that, no, they're not the same person, but the best versions of themselves from then is still a part of who they are now. And that is what Picard and Crusher are able to drag out of Riker and help him rediscover. In many ways, I think what's really beautiful is that they rekindle the magic for Riker. And they actually reignite the spark of life in him. Because in many ways, Will's been dead emotionally. And in many, and our most important parts, if you're dead emotionally, you're just kind of dead. You're just kind of like ghost walking through life. And so they've brought him back to life. We got a resurrection here. It's the resurrection of Will Riker.
And that relates to something else that I was going to mention after listening to what you were describing earlier. We are talking here about parallels with the original series and how Nick Meyer took characters from TOS and transformed them for the films. And one theme that we got through the original series movies is this idea, and it really started in the motion picture, that Kirk's place is on the bridge of a starship out in space exploring. Kirk's place isn't back on Earth. It's not sitting behind a desk. It's not teaching. It's none of this stuff. He needs to be out there or else he's lost some core of who he is. And I think we see that mirrored in Riker's story here, that Riker realizes at the end of this episode that this is where he belongs. He needs to be out here exploring this incredible universe. And even before the death of his son, I wonder if getting away from the starship bridge, getting away from exploration, settling down the way that they did, if that started to take away part of who he was. And as long as everything was still happy with the family and the kids, he could build a new life and maybe find a new path. But then when Thaddeus was gone, everything started to crumble because at his core, he wasn't where he is supposed to be.
I mean, I think that that's a good point in the sense that for Riker, his first best destiny is being on the bridge of a starship as well. And, you know, I think, I love that you said that because I think it harkens to another character that I would like to discuss, and the fact of Beverly saving the day. But as you were speaking, Beverly has that moment where she begins to quote, you know, to seek out new life.
Mm-hmm.
Beverly, by willingly exiling herself and her son, has also taken away, in many ways, her best self from herself, right? And I think that there's a realization moment there for her that she's missed out in the last 20 years of doing what she was meant to be doing. And I think that that's really interesting. Again, I think that what we are seeing is that these characters, this is what they were born to do,
mm-hmm.
right? And by, you know, not doing that, they're actually hurting the galaxy at large. And I think that, you know, obviously that's a Star Trek thing, right? That these characters, like you were talking about with Kirk, and we think of, like, in many ways, almost every single person in Star Trek is kind of this way, but I think Beverly is the same way. And so it's really kind of beautiful that, you know, her and Jack are able to come up with this idea, all based on the realization that she realizes they're in a celestial womb,
mm-hmm.
and that this is a countdown to a birth. And so they're going to hitch a free ride. Come on and take a free ride. Anyway, on one of those electrical shockwaves and recharge the warp core and escape. And I think it's a really beautiful thing because, you know, as Beverly's helping Riker see what he needs to do and who he's meant to be and everything, I think in some ways the character herself is rediscovering that mm-hmm. as well. And that to trust in the community that they have with each other, the friendship that they have with each other, it's always allowed them to be great together, right? They're all good people on their own, but they're great together. And so, yeah, I think, you know, you could absolutely tell why Gates and Fadden would be so excited to be a part of this season, because in many ways, she's been the linchpin for this season. And, you know, the fact that they're not dead, it has to do with her and her realization of where they are and how they can utilize it to their benefit.
Oh, she's definitely been the linchpin to the season. And it's almost like it's a Beverly story, really, from the very mm-hmm. start. But yeah, this theme of loss has been a big theme through the first four episodes. And like you say, she's been wallowing in loss for all these years, which is reflected in what we see of her environment in the opening of the series in the first episode, and how she's come out of that. Riker is coming out of that sense of loss. Picard as well. Jack as well by the end of this. And then we also see it reflected in Shaw. And here we finally find out why Shaw resents Picard so much, mm-hmm. and also why he refuses to call Seven by the name that she prefers because of its Borg connection. And this part of the story was really interesting to me because I actually felt like, I mean, you mentioned Riker and Jonathan Frakes' performance as he's trying to write a letter to Deanna and he's reflecting on the things that had happened to him. But, you know, I think Todd Stashwick here as Shaw gives yes. an amazing performance as he tells the story of the Battle of Wolf 359 and does it in a way that, and you mentioned this earlier, sort of the different tone of this character, and he does mm-hmm. it in a way that's not what we normally expect from a Starfleet officer. And so we could talk about that, but then I also want to talk with you, of course, because we do the Orb together. We're both big Niners of hell.
Yeah.
As they keep digging into every corner of Star Trek lore and creating parallels and references in this season of Picard, they've obviously gone back into DS9 here and mm-hmm. grabbed the Sisko storyline and his relationship with Picard, but they've put a little bit of a twist on it.
Well, I mean, it all comes back to Deep Space Nine, Chris. So a couple of things. So you mentioned the speech itself, and the way that Todd Stashwick plays this is phenomenal. And it's been noted many places, and I picked up on it as well, is that this is very reminiscent of Quint and Jaws when he talks about his survival on the USS Indianapolis and the fact that he survives and the fact that he has this survivor's guilt. And I think the fact that Shaw was at Wolf 359 and suffers from PTSD and the survivor's guilt here is really interesting, and it goes to show the way in which people can hide from counselors and stuff for a long time. And there's this breaking point here for this character, because he's literally come face to face now with the man who he blames for his PTSD and his survivor's guilt, the fact that he has it in the first place, mm-hmm. which is really interesting because, and I'm going to say this because the character does, but the character has lost his charm, and he's just become what he calls a raging asshole.
Mm-hmm. But he realizes that about himself.
Exactly.
Which is the key point.
Right. And you get the feeling like this was a man who, before this happened, most likely was a fun-loving, quippy, Tom Paris type of character, right? Mm-hmm. He has the modern vernacular that harkens back to the past, especially the 20th century, 21st century, and seems to be somebody who was very comfortable with those type of things. And yet, there's this moment in his life where he's been irreparably damaged. And I think what's kind of great about this story is that it gives us an opportunity to see what would have happened to Benjamin Sisko if the prophets had not intervened to help him see the error of his thinking. The fact that he was stuck in the past, and with Shaw, he is who Sisko would have been if that hadn't have happened. And so I think it's a very nice twist on that idea. And instead, because of circumstance, or as fate would have it, the gift of providence, Shaw has actually come face to face with his demon. And I think in many ways had an intense therapy session, which mm-hmm. has allowed him to come face to face with himself and see who he is. Especially when Picard doesn't fight him on it, doesn't tell him he's wrong, just takes it and walks away. And again, this is another place where I think the writing is really good. Part of that, it's because it's paying homage to what's come before, but giving its own spin on it. And you know, I think that it's really good, because we also get the opportunity to see, I think, Shaw and Seven be able to have some movement forward where they realize they don't actually think all that differently from each other. Mm-hmm. And maybe they're not that different. And so, you know, again, it's an incredibly well-crafted story where all the pieces are fitting together, and you do feel like, as you're watching the season, somebody had painstakingly thought through over and over and over again, okay, what needs to happen for this to happen, for this to happen? It's like they knew what the end was, and they were mm-hmm. able to write towards that, and it's really refreshing.
Yeah, I like how they have brought Shaw and Seven together. And I think Shaw finally, there's a moment of realization when he asks Seven, how did you know that LaForge was a changeling? And she says, well, Ensign LaForge always calls me Commander Seven, out of respect. And then you see that look on Shaw's face. I think he realizes in that moment that there is something to that.
Yes.
So, okay, while we're talking about changelings, we have to talk about Vadic, because I feel like, well, there's already been some speculation, and I think we discussed it last time a little bit. Is Vadic a changeling? Are all the people on the ship with her changelings, or are they Jem'Hadar? What are they? And there's been fan speculation about Vadic being a changeling. And then I saw someone comment, I saw a review soon after the episode aired, and in the review, the person wrote, Vadic was revealed as being a changeling. And I had watched the episode one time, and I thought, really? Are we sure? Because I don't think it was made clear. It seemed that way at first, but then she has to use a knife to sort of push off or cut off part of her hand, which then becomes this demon head, which does seem to be at least the material, the goo, the residue, as Shaw would call it, that changelings are made of. But as she's doing it, she winces. And so it really came across as an organic being who has some kind of attachment that it's painful to remove. And that is some kind of communication device or monitoring device or something that is a changeling or made of residue. But then you included in our outline a tweet from Terry Metalis, who answers a fan asking the same question and noting that Odo didn't need a knife to detach bits of himself. And Metalis clearly states, Vadic and her gang are changelings. She does not have a special hand. So what are your thoughts on this? Because, of course, I'll roll with it. It's Metalis' story, and if that's how they want to portray changelings here, that's fine. But I just think as a viewer, as a niner, as someone who has immersed myself in the whole changeling lore mm-hmm. for so many years, this part was not clear mm-hmm. to me that Vadic is a changeling, and it almost seemed to imply that she's being controlled by changelings, but right. isn't one herself.
Yeah, the character is called The Face in the credits and says that Vadic's people are expendable. So I guess mm-hmm. there's a couple questions. One, are all changelings involved expendable so that the changelings aren't actually the ones that are at the top of this? Or does this faction of the changelings have some sort of caste system now that we're not aware of because they're an offshoot, right, of the Great Link? And it brings to mind the character of Loss from Deep Space Nine, who is also one of the 100, right?
Oh, right.
You know, mm-hmm. so, like, we've seen different versions of changelings in the sense of, like, their attitudes and that kind of thing. And being an offshoot of the Great Link, in many ways, everything that we know about changelings doesn't necessarily have to apply to them in the sense of the way that they behave as a group, because they could have a whole new way of doing things basically 20 years later. Mm-hmm. And so I think that this is something that is really interesting. And I was talking to our friend Bruce Gibson about this, and he was even saying too that this, you know, this really seems to be one of the things that's the most difficult to kind of figure out exactly what's going on here. I'll be interested to see if, you know, as we watch through the rest of the episodes, was there anything that was planted in those first few episodes that kind of did let you know? You just didn't know what to be looking for.
Yeah, there very well could be.
But, you know, I think with the left hand of Vatic here, it's really weird because it looks like she's also cutting herself with a Riemann knife. So there's that as, you know, could that be the behind the scenes of some of the people that are involved in this? And I mean, there's just so many interesting questions that are being raised here. And I honestly, I've been racking my brain kind of like for days since this episode came out, trying to figure this out. And I don't know. Because the other thing that doesn't make any sense right now is that why are they so intent on getting Jack? Jack seems to be like the MacGuffin of the series. It's not Picard. It's actually Jack. That you know, as Beverly was speculating that they really wanted Jean-Luc, but and to get back at him. But no, they apparently want him for some reason, and he keeps having these weird visions. So, one, who is saying that they're going to be reunited with him soon and to find them? And what does it have to do with changelings and whoever might possibly be behind all of this? Like, it's just, I honestly don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. I've been thinking about it a bit as well. And, well, we know now that the branches, which we speculated previously were going to be their way of getting out of the nebula, turn out to be something different and are connected to this a situation where someone is seeking Jack and there's some kind of, appears to be some kind of mental link because he's having these visions. As for Vatic and the changelings and all, it introduces a lot of interesting questions. Now, it is established, Worf said, that it's not the whole Great Link that's doing this. It's not the Dominion. It's a group of renegade changelings. And I guess that's going to be the explanation as to how there are differences in these changelings and what we're familiar with. Maybe it's similar to in Descent, how Lore was leading that group of Borg that behaved differently than the rest of the collective.
Exactly.
Something like that. It raises a lot of questions, though. You know, the Great Link is the idea that all changelings are ultimately a single entity. It's kind of complicated. You and I have discussed it on The Orb. We have an entire episode of The Orb where we delve into this question of what is the Great Link and how much individuality is there. And from some years ago, we talked about that. And here, it almost seems like the changelings have some kind of caste system. And as you said, some are expendable. That's certainly not the attitude that the Great Link would have, where no changeling had ever killed another.
Right.
So it's quite different. And when you introduce the face, a character like this, that's obviously getting into the kind of standard plot line of there being some kind of leader, some entity that others are underneath and who's guiding things. You know, maybe we'll find out that this is actually Voldemort and that Voldemort was really a changeling and that the Harry Potter universe or Harry Potter and Star Trek exist in the same universe or something like that. I don't know.
But, I mean, talk about in your face.
But this whole thing raises a lot of questions. And then the fact that when the face tells Vatic to pursue and Vatic's like, no, 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 no. And seems legitimately scared of the idea of pursuing the Titan because imagine with all the weaponry on the ship and that portal device, obviously they can't really pursue because the ship would end up being destroyed, which of course all makes sense. But her reaction doesn't make sense for what we know of changelings. And so I think that we're going to see an interesting evolution of the concept of changelings here.
Right.
But it does feel like it's going to be done independently of the Great Link. So it doesn't actually taint the changelings that we knew on DS9 and what the Great Link is. It's just this, it'll be an exploration, I guess, of what happens if a group of people who have been part of a society or a system find themselves separated from it, and then what path might they go down in that case? It's sort of like on Deep Space Nine, when we see what would happen to Jim Hadar if they weren't addicted to Ketracel White, for example.
Well, I think that, you know, this whole discussion is really interesting and a great way to be able to extrapolate and explore this idea. And very specifically, the changelings themselves were monolithic on purpose. Mm-hmm. They themselves wanted to be monolithic because, as we know, a drop is part of the ocean and an ocean is part of the drop, right? And so, but the idea that there would have been a schism in the Great Link after the war, where this other group completely excommunicated itself from the rest of the Link, and then the idea that they would then create their own rules and their old understanding for the society and all of that, I think makes complete sense. And so the fact that they would be different, and I think you brought up the perfect example of Lore and his Borg in Descent. And in fact, you know, I even think of Voyager, right, where we run into the group who used to be part of the Borg, but they're left on that planet and they're disconnected from the Borg then.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I mean, that's a good point. We've played with this idea of people in societies, you know, becoming insulated from who they used to be and becoming different. So I think that this just gives them that opportunity. But what I love about this, in all honesty, is that I think that there have been some places in this season, and this is not me in any way complaining, but I've been able to tell, okay, I know what they're going to do here. With this, I still don't know. And this is the big mystery of the series, of this season. I love that. And so, you know, and too, you know, we haven't talked about, you know, the fact that Seven's on the hunt here. And so what did you think about this whole idea about there being like the look of the changelings themselves, the residue in the bucket, you know, the residue, did all of that stuff feel like it worked well enough for you?
Like in connection to the past and like updating.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we ever thought that, or maybe we never actually knew that Odo left any residue in his bucket at all, that there was a piece of him. Though I think it would be hard for there not to be some of his DNA in that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know.
Yeah. No, I think it works well for me. It's one of those things that, unless it's pertinent to a story, especially in the early 1990s and the way they had to do special effects at that time, there wouldn't be a need to go to the expense of showing residue in a bucket or residue left behind by changelings, because it would have been, you know, an additional thing to have to pay for. From a special effects standpoint. And so that kind of stuff, I don't even, you know, think about. If they want to add that stuff now, I think it's great. I think it's one of those cases where, as your means of storytelling improve with technology and it becomes feasible to give us things that weren't possible in the past, then definitely go ahead and do that, because it makes the world feel more real. I don't know if all fans would agree with me on this, but I think you go back to the motion picture and the update of the look of the Klingons in the motion picture, which is often cited as a justification for changing them and other aliens today. But I feel it's a bit different, because at that point in time, it was very much we now have the money to do the makeup and make these aliens look really different, and let's do it because it adds something to the feeling of the world that we're playing in at that point. And so here with the residue and the look of the changelings, when they go into their goo state and all, I think it's great. Works really well for me. Mm-hmm. The one thing, again, that as we've just been talking about with respect to this, that I'm not sure how I feel about yet is the face and Vatic cutting that off. I don't know the right verb. You know, I don't think cut is the right word, but like pushing this stuff off of her hand and then it becoming this face, just because based on everything that we've seen in Star Trek over the years, that particular effect of the face coming up, it doesn't feel like Star Trek to me. It feels like it's from some other franchise and it's been pulled in. And so that was a little bit jarring for me, but otherwise the rest of the changeling stuff I think has worked very well for me.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think, you know, the whole idea of Seven not really having any information about the changelings, because of course they were in the Delta Quadrant when that was happening, and so the idea that that would not be the case makes complete sense, and that she would want to go to somebody who, you know, had been a part of the Dominion War, and that would have been Shaw. And so I think, you know, that really works. And you know, I enjoyed the search. I don't care that the bucket looks like Odo's bucket or a version of Odo's bucket, whatever, folks.
Well, there's even, you know, Odo's like, face down in the bottom corner of the pad.
But of course, you know, Odo is the only changeling that has been seen on screen for a long period of time. So,
let's put it this way: on that where the Great Link is, I don't think there are a lot of buckets scattered around everywhere, and they're coming out of the Great Link, and they're like spending time in the buckets, right? So the fact that it has a connection to Odo makes sense, because most changelings don't need to keep a bucket around
exactly
to sleep in.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. No. So, I mean, look, and I think that, you know, sometimes we as fans, look, I love this season so far. I love that we have so much to talk seriously about and really dig into and all of that. But can we not forget that this is also supposed to be fun, right?
Right.
And in many ways, that's a wonderful just little wink to the camera to say, you know what? Remember Rene and his character of Odo, who we're paying homage to here? This is how we're remembering him.
Mm-hmm.
And just get over yourself, fans, for being way too serious on this point. There's just no reason to be that serious at this point.
Well, Matthew, I've never heard anyone say Star Trek fans are too serious about these things before. Where is that coming from?
I don't know.
Are you serious? Star Trek fans overanalyzing things? us overanalyzing things?
To quote another franchise, why so serious?
Yeah.
Anyway.
All right. Last point here before we wrap up. One thing that you had mentioned to me that we can just briefly talk about is the fact that as beautiful as the Titan is inside and out, it does feel a little bit claustrophobic at times.
So I get the fact this ship is obviously meant to feel like the Enterprise A, and specifically I would say the Enterprise A from the Undiscovered Country, where there is this tighter, more submarine, claustrophobic feel to it. But I also do miss the fact that on our hero ship we would have places like engineering and a lounge and those kind of things. And you know, even a ship that is like this would still have those amenities to it. You know, it's not like they would just like strip all of that out because people don't need it on a ship this size. I mean, this is not the Defiant, right? So I do miss that. It's not a criticism in the sense that like I'm really upset about it. It's more of a thing to which they've obviously spent an incredible amount of money to make this show look great.
Mm-hmm.
I think the special effects are phenomenal. If they don't give me this season in 4K like they're doing with Strange New Worlds, I'm going to riot, because this season deserves to be seen on a 4K disc. Mm-hmm. Because I think they've done a wonderful job in that way. But, I mean, so far the ship has like four rooms in the same hallway, and I just would love to have there be more. And my mm-hmm. guess is that the reason that they've kept that at bay is because I think starting with episode 5 and beyond, we are going to be spending places. I mean, you know, we're going to go back to Worf and Rafi. We're going to go see Geordi at some point. And then there's going to be probably a bunch of other sets as the season ends. And so you're talking about, okay, how do we spend our money? Where do we spend our money? And all that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. I do miss that. And so I, you know, again, there's something special about like being able to see the engineering section of a ship. I always, like what the design of that would be is always cool to me.
That's the one that stands out most to me when you and I were talking about this on the other side of the tango. What are we calling this now? When we were talking about this before we were recording, because engineering and the warp core is always such an iconic part of every Star Trek series, every incarnation of Star Trek. And it's often been a centerpiece of the design updates and the identity of each series, right? And each ship. And so,
exactly.
Yeah, I do miss seeing what engineering would look like. And, well, we won't get Data back. I was going to say, if Geordi did come on the ship and if Data came back, we could watch them test unknown alien devices right next to the warp core like they used to do in the Next Generation. Like, hey, we found this alien laser. I wonder what it does. Let's set it up next to the warp core and test it out. But anyway, otherwise, yeah, it would be nice to see more areas of the ship and get that feeling of the ship a bit more. But I think you're right that sets are expensive to build and you can only do a certain number of them unless that's where you want to put all of your money. And something very obvious about this season visually is that it's 10 episodes of television being produced to a cinematic standard visually. It looks more like a film than it does a typical television series. And so the cost of doing that has to be higher than what we've been seeing in the previous seasons. And so I'm sure a lot of money is going into that and the special effects and all, which may be limiting how many sets they want to build, especially if they're not necessary to the story. Like, let's build what we really need for the story. Mm-hmm. Let's try to get by with smaller things that imply that we're somewhere bigger if we can. You know, the scene with Shaw and Seven having Shaw hotwire than the cells, they don't need to show a big space for that, right? That's something where they can get away with something small. So I think that's probably the reason. But yeah, I do wish we could see more of the ship for sure.
So I do have one question for you, Chris, before we wrap up, because, you know, this episode obviously focuses completely on the Titan, and we get nothing from Rafi and Worf in this episode. And do you feel like that was the best choice here for this episode specifically?
Yeah, I do, because everything we talked about today, the relationships primarily, and overcoming loss and finding that best version of yourself for each of these characters, I am glad that we just focused on the situation that they're in. And we had the flashbacks, which are important for the relationship with Picard and Jack. But otherwise, we're focused on what's happening with these characters right now. I think it would have had a lot less impact and been less effective, and also would have watered down the character arcs if we had been spending time jumping over to see what's going on with Worf and Raffi, and then coming back to this and maybe doing that a couple of times. I think it's better to focus and reach the end of this arc of the story, which,
right.
I mean, we might be wrong. Maybe this isn't the end of an arc, but it certainly does feel that way. Mm-hmm. And then we can go and deal with this other stuff, because what Worf and Raffi are doing, that's going to be tied into the bigger question of what's going on with the threat. And I think for Picard and Riker and Beverly in particular, Jack and Shaw, Seven, to play their best role in preventing the disaster, which Jack seems to be seeing. I kept freeze framing to try to see what was in that vision with the door opening. And it looks like Jack is, he's seeing a vision of a city being destroyed. It looks like there are a few buildings left standing. And so they need to stop this from happening. And we needed to make their characters whole so that they can then go on and achieve that goal of preventing that. So yeah, I like that they didn't jump back and forth here.
No, I agree with you. I think that the biggest part of this is that we, like you said, needed these characters to move past the place that they are, which is there is some healing that needs to happen. And to do that, we need to spend time specifically with them. And to do that in an uninterrupted way allows that to happen in a way that feels more narratively true than if you were bouncing back and forth between actual different parts of the story. All of these parts of the story have to do with just one piece, which is the Titan. And so I think it was absolutely the right choice to do because, as you mentioned, now we have left that nebula. And as Picard's narration wraps up, which was great to hear, the Admiral's log there, that there are still so many questions to be answered, and that's how every fan feels. But now we feel better about answering those questions because we're not looking to answer questions about characters' emotional being. In fact, now we can watch them become the better versions of themselves because of what they went through for the rest of the season.
Yeah, and I think that's going to play better for a lot of fans who felt like season two was just too much emotion all the way through and too heavy. We're probably going to get a bit more of the adventure from here to the end. Yeah, we'll see. Yeah,
well, and I think, you know, I've heard fans also can compare and be thankful that this season is finding a way to not just drag everything out in that sense. Being frustrated. I've never watched Discovery really, but being frustrated that Discovery seemed to do that a lot with its characters.
Yeah.
And so they seem to have kind of learned that lesson. So you're having to walk that. We've talked a lot about this idea. There's a tightrope that they're walking. And I think what we're finding so far, this is the fourth episode, they're definitely walking the tightrope well.
Yep, I think so. All right. Any final thoughts? What's your rating for this one?
You know, I think the more that I've watched this episode, and in all honesty, the more that it's even grown on me, and I think the thing I appreciate the most about it is the way in which the series has allowed itself to have some time here. And so that we can truly dig into characters and talk about them and see who they are. I specifically think of the way in which these first four episodes have really dealt with the character of Shaw. Of course, Picard and Jack and Beverly and Will. All of these characters are, I mean, I think except for Jack, who's still a bit of enigma, and the rest of them are better versions of themselves from where we've been. And I'm very excited to see where we go next. So yeah, I'm going to give this a good 9 out of 10 hot-wired nacelles.
Mm, excellent. If you've got 9 hot-wired nacelles, you can ride that wave out even more quickly. I mean, there's no chance that you're not going to get out of the nebula.
Exactly. I mean, talk about a free ride.
Exactly. All right. Yeah, I've shared most of my thoughts on it. The one thing I didn't mention is that I really liked how we end the episode with all these space babies.
Yeah.
That they're not the same, but they're similar enough that they really make you think of Encounter at Farpoint. And Picard actually at one point had referenced Farpoint. And just as bookends of where we started with the Next Generation and this being the final journey of them together and having that visual similarity and that situation where they have a mystery and they solve and it results in the birth of some kind of life form. I thought that also was just a really nice callback and a nice homage to the history of the series and these characters in particular being involved in it. So I'm going to give this episode 9 grease monkeys.
Fantastic.
All right, everyone, we would love to hear your thoughts on No Win Scenario. If you'd like to share those, there are many ways for you to do that. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's designed to extend the conversations beyond the podcasts. So it is a closed group just for listeners. If you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. You'll find a post there on the timeline for this episode, and you can share your thoughts with Matthew and me and fellow listeners right there. And the way to find it is to type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook. If it doesn't come up, just type the Babel Conference. And you can also send us email if you'd like to do that. Go to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose the artificial tango. And that message will dance its way over to Matthew and me. And you can find us in social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. And we would love to get a rating and a review from you. So if your podcast app of choice allows you to do that, please leave that and let us know what you think of the show. And we thank everyone who has rated us and reviewed us so far. Now, Matthew, when you're not telling tales of your past life over a bottle of whiskey and a holographic simulation, where can people find you?
Well, unlike Jack, I don't like the cheap stuff. So make sure it's the good stuff there. But maybe like a nice Lagavulin or, you know, Macallan 18 or something like that. So yes, I have expensive tastes. But you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02, Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, and Vero are the places I am most active. Of course, here on the network, I am on our other side of the network called the 602 Club, where we just sit down and have a drink and talk about all of those fandoms we love. So please check that out. We have a great time over there, Christy and I. Some great bonus shows in there as well on more focused subjects, all in the same feed. You can also find Literary Treks doing the books and the comics of Star Trek. Chris, you and I do the Orb. We've got the 30th anniversary of Deep Space Nine going on right now. We've got Warp 5 with the 20th anniversary of Star Trek Enterprise. And then Saddle Up is about Strange New Worlds. And, you know, I know both you and I are, I'm ready for that to come out again. So you can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network. I've got 2 shows. One is called Owl Post. That is about Harry Potter, talking about every single chapter, one chapter at a time. And you can also find me on Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills, talking about Star Wars every week. But, you know, Chris, when you're not dancing the night away, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me, as you mentioned, elsewhere on the network with you doing all of those shows. You can find Larry Nemechek and me doing the Ready Room from time to time. And you can find me in many episodes in the back catalog on various shows. And when I'm not doing that, of course, I am busy putting together magazines here in Tokyo and other things. And I'd love to chat with you about Star Trek or Japan or whatever you want to chat about in social media. You could find me under the name C. Brian Jones, letter C, and Brian with a Y. That is my username everywhere in social media. Twitter is where I'm most active, and you can also find me on Mastodon, Trekkies.social, instance, see Brian Jones there as well. And I look forward to talking to you. And if you'd like to help us keep this show and everything that we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to get involved, just visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. We wouldn't be here without the support of all of you. So thank you so much to everyone who has become a patron. And if you're not yet, we hope that you will. So thank you so very, very much. Well, Matthew, I'm looking forward to next time and finding out with you just who the imposters are.
I am as well. So, Chris, engage.